You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 29th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Kalispera to all of our listeners in Greece and the surrounding islands.
I wonder if you pronounce that properly.
We'll find out.
I think my best has been like, I don't know, you had to put a percentage
English?
On it, I think like
60%. English?
Barely.
Only barely.
All right, July 2nd.
Yes, July 2nd. So July 2nd, we mark the passing of Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy. He succumbed to bronchitis on this day in 1843.
They hadn't created a cure for bronchitis via homeopathy yet, but I'm sure they've done it now. Using spittle from Hahnemann's lungs, actually, that's been reduced and diluted spittle, over and over again.
Spittleus lungus, yes, that's the official name of the fraction of a atom that's left in the solution to cure you of your bronchitis.
What homeopaths should do is they should get like this: find the sickest person in the world. And then do like a homeopathic preparation of them. You know, like just take a piece of them and dilute it a million times.
I wonder what Hahnemann would think of his legacy.
Oh, he'd be thrilled.
Yeah, I think he would be.
From what I've read a little bit about him in his history, he was always very suspicious of what was modern medicine at the time. But look, rightfully so, because a lot of things that was being passed off as medicine at the time was more likely to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Than help you. But at the same time, he would go off on and say a lot of same things that you hear a lot of alternative medical practitioners today say. It's kind of using the same language and stuff. Did you know he thought at one point that many of the diseases of the world were caused by coffee?
Wow.
No.
Yep.
I think it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
What was now, his reasoning?
Everyone drinks it, everyone gets sick.
Around the start of the 19th century, Hahnemann developed a theory propounded in his 1803 essay on the effects of coffee from original observations. It just goes on to say that he later abandoned that theory in favor of the theory that disease is caused by psora, P-S-O-R-A.
Yes. Miasmas.
Psora right. What?
Psora bones.
Psora disease.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but that's like a vitalistic
notion. Oh, it's totally vitalistic, yep. Magical energy. Yeah, that's
magical
right.
Energy, yep.
Essence. Problem with your essence, so you got to give you the essence of something else, even though you dilute it out of existence, the essence is still there. It's magic. It's all magic.
Mm-hmm. Pure magic. So there you have it. So Hahnemann on this day.
Rest in peace.
Well, earlier this week on Tuesday... On Tuesday, June 28th, was another special day, Evan. You're going to tell
us
that.
That's right. One cannot mention this special day without going back a couple months and noting that March 14th, or on the calendar, 314, which is known as Pi Day because of its resemblance to the first three digits in the decimal expansion of the number pi. And pi is defined as the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. But according to physicist Michael Hartle, the true circle constant is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its radius, not to its diameter. And this number is called tau, and it's equal to 2 times pi, or as if you extend it out to its decimals, 6.28, which on the calendar is June 28th, hence Tau Day.
Tau Day, right. So why do we care?
It's not to be confused with Towel Day, the day we celebrate Douglas Adams. Just put
right.
That out there in case people are confused by our accents.
Well, there are physicists, mathematicians, and others in the scientific community that are looking to basically replace the notion of pi with the notion of tau because they feel that it's easier, makes a lot more common sense, and easier for kids to learn as they're going through their geometry, trigonometry classes, and so forth.
So, obviously, the constants are the same thing, right? The tau is twice pi, but it makes a difference in calculations whether or not you have to account for you know, make that adjustment to pi. So in some applications, it's easier to use tau because having to constantly, you know, multiply by the factor of 2. But engineers, from reading the comments, at least this article, seem to prefer pi because they are often dealing with diameters, right? If you're measuring a pipe, it's easier to measure the diameter of a pipe than the radius. Of course, you can just divide by 2 and you get the radius. So it all seems to be the same to me in the end. It's just a matter of for some applications, the formulas will be a little bit simpler if you use tau. For others, they'll be a little bit simpler if you use pi. But what's interesting is how emotional and invested people get in this debate.
The comments are great.
Tau.
Skip the article and just read the comments. They're fantastic.
Everything and more you want to learn about pi, tau, and
I know,
and it's other things having to do with
in
circles.
My book. You know, I think, well, can't we all just get along, right? But in my book, it's all good because anything that promotes, you know, an understanding or interest or just promoting math is great. You know, just so that's fine. Let them duke it out. Let more people read about it. Let more people learn about it. That's fine. I don't care what happens. It's just great that I'm reading a news item about math and people are passionate about it.
Mathematicians really are, though, the worst when it comes to online arguments like that. Because, I mean,
blanket statement.
Well, you know, when I think of never-ending internet argument, I think of two. One would be Joel versus Mike, and the other would be 1 = 0.999999999.
Oh, yes.
Oh, boy.
And you know, obviously mathematicians aren't responsible for the MST3K argument, but yeah, the 1 = 0.9, how do you say that?
0.9 to infinity, basically.
With a slash over the top of the 9.
There's a word for the slash infinity. Over the top. I don't know. Some mathematicians can write in and yell at me for not getting it. But you just post that sometime, just in the middle of a forum thread about anything, and it'll explode with mathematicians.
Right. Clearly, it does equal 1.
But I'm glad you said that so that we can have a bunch of angry people write in.
It's just not aesthetic. People don't like the aesthetic of thinking that 0.999 to infinity equals 1, but it clearly does.
And there's a proof for it.
But more importantly, who gives a shit?
You're about to find out.
Yeah, right? Wait, I think we just got our first email. I see it. Oh, boy.
And anyone who disagrees with me is objectively wrong. But that's the thing, like the tau pi debate. You know, there are certain things in science and systems like math where you just make arbitrary choices. No one is right or another one is wrong. You know, all the symbolism that we use and the particular way that we, you know, do formulas and whatnot, there are some arbitrary choices in there, like whether or not you, you know, divide by the radius or the diameter. They're both right. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of form. But it is funny how well people get invested.
Yeah, but
in
Steve,
that.
I mean, but a good argument. Some people argue that one or the other would facilitate learning and make it easier to actually learn these concepts. And that to me, that's a good argument. That's a good reason
prove
to
it.
Choose.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's it.
I doubt it. I mean, I think that I don't think that pi is inhibiting anybody from learning geometry.
Did you go to the Tau Manifesto website?
Yes,
Michael
I
Hartl's
did.
Website, and he gives you some very, I think, pretty clear diagrams to follow and explaining how tau is – I think he makes a graceful argument about how tau it makes for a better learning experience when you're first learning about circumference, area, and so forth.
Well, yeah, but obviously there's no objective data to back that up.
No.
Again, it comes down to aesthetics. It works either way. And I think the concepts are the same either way. All right, well, let's go on. Bob, you're going to tell us how scientists have managed to measure the body temperatures of dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's been an interesting...
Rectal thermometer.
A very old rectal thermometer.
Sorry,
oh,
I just had to get the joke in before you even started.
Thanks for getting it over with early. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Go on.
Right up the KT boundary. Go ahead.
Oh, nice. Well, there's been an interesting development in this whole cold-blooded, warm-blooded dinosaur debate, if you're even aware of it. It's a brand new method has been developed to reveal the most accurate body temperature of dinosaurs to date. Now, the results show that some dinosaurs, at least, were as warm-blooded as many modern mammals are, but they were cooler than birds, the data shows. And all of this, though, is accurate within 1 or 2 degrees Celsius. They didn't really go into any detail, though, how they actually determined that level of accuracy. I assume they did some of these tests on animals that they know what the temperatures are. But this is led by researchers at California Institute of Technology, especially Robert Eagle. They used the teeth of sauropods like Brachiosaurus and Camarasaurus to determine that they were in fact warmer than crocodiles and alligators, both extant and extinct. Their temperatures were, 38°C and 101 Fahrenheit for the Brachiosaurus, and the other dinosaurs was 36°C and 96 Fahrenheit. So kind of warm. So you would think, after hearing that, oh, this resolves the debate, right? I mean, doesn't this mean that dinos were warm-blooded then? And well, the answer, of course, is no. As we often find in science, obvious conclusions aren't necessarily correct, and things often get more complicated as you look into the details. We see that so often. So for a little background, it's kind of funny. I was doing research at some of the old depictions of dinosaurs, and you see these really slow, kind of plodding, dumb animals, typical of what you'd expect, really, from just a big, cold-blooded lizard. But over the years, though, this conception has changed as we learn more about the actual lifestyles of dinosaurs. And this is, of course, exemplified by the swift, smart velociraptors that we've all seen in Jurassic Park. So many scientists now think that dinosaurs were, in fact, probably warm-blooded. But the evidence to really prove it, though, is often contradictory. And as you can imagine, it's hard. I mean, how the hell do you accurately determine the internal temperature of extinct fossilized animals? Many scientists thought, hey, this is impossible. I mean, they couldn't possibly imagine how it could be done. Essentially, they have done it now. So what's been described is essentially, somebody described this as essentially putting a thermometer under an extinct animal's tongue. And in a way, that's kind of what they did. They did it by examining the different amounts of different types of carbon-13 and oxygen-18 in the enamel of the teeth. So the lower the temperature, the more that these elements will be bound together. So this is called clumped isotope technique. The clumped isotope technique kind of makes sense. It turns out, therefore, that body temperature has a direct effect on the amounts of these elements. And this is obviously a great technique because thermodynamics is thermodynamics. So, you know, it's the same today as it was millions of years ago. Things aren't changing unless you ascribe to the theory that scientific laws are not immutable. Some do. So back to the resolution of the debate. You know, it may seem obvious that since they were so warm, they must have been warm-blooded, right? I mean, it kind of makes sense. But it's, like I said, it's a little bit more complicated than that. The lead researcher, Robert Eagle, he's quoted as saying that our analysis really allows us to rule out that they could have been cold, like crocodiles, for example. This doesn't necessarily mean, though, that these large dinosaurs had high metabolisms like mammals and birds. And that's really the crux of this thing. You know, that's because the two dinosaurs that were studied were really huge. I mean, these were like, I think the Brachiosaurus was 40 tons and the Camarasaurus was like 15 tons. So these are really gargantuan animals. And so this makes them, I hadn't heard this term before, they were gigantotherms, which means that their huge body mass actually helps them retain a lot of the heat that their body produces.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Plus also, if you're cold-blooded, it doesn't mean that your body temperature is cold. It means that it's just whatever the ambient temperature is.
Right.
So what if you're a cold-blooded animal living in the tropics? You're going to be warm, right?
Right. So that makes me think, maybe they had some sort of weird hybrid metabolism. I guess that's possible, something that maybe was in between somehow. But, I mean, couldn't gigantotherms be cold-blooded? And just, you know, obviously it would take a long time to heat your body up. But once you did that, the gigantothermism comes into play or whatever, then you would kind of maintain that high body heat and only lose a little bit over the night. So perhaps, you know, maybe they could have been cold-blooded in a sense. But, it seems obvious to me, and maybe this is just, you know, silly and if you really knew this stuff inside out. So one of the ways to resolve this, obviously, is you got to look at some of these smaller dinosaurs because they were just looking at the big guys, some of the big guys. So, and that's really what their plan is. They're going to look at some of the smaller dinosaurs and see what their temperatures were And so either way, I suspect this debate will last a little while, but this is actually a really interesting technique that they developed, and it's amazing how accurate they could be just by looking at the teeth. It's amazing what you discover.
Yeah,
you
know, that is cool.
Looking at teeth, oh yeah, we could find out what the body temperature is. It's fascinating stuff.
But when you think about it, why does metabolism have to be bimodal? Why would there just be cold-blooded and warm-blooded? Why couldn't there be something in between?
Right. And if it's a long time ago, who knows? I'm just hoping that the information is somehow there in the fossils that could really let us know that yeah, this really was this this other way, this other type of metabolism that existed. But I mean, it's just bones. It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
But hey,
yeah.
They thought this was impossible to get this far. So who knows what information is buried deep in that new techniques in the future may discover.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of the rings in a tree when they cut it down.
Dendrochronology.
Why?
What do you mean, why?
Yeah, what do you mean? What kind of question is that?
Because there's information inside the tree, like you could...
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. No. Yeah, you're right, Jay. No, you're right, yep. And that from that angle, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I was just wondering what your angle was.
It kind of reminds me when somebody gets their arm cut off.
Have you guys heard about the study where they demonstrated that a large magnetic field could increase blood flow?
Yes, but a very large magnetic field.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, possibly to our detriment.
How large is it?
So, this is, I think, gets the prize for the most emailed news item in the last week. Because, combine the concepts of using a magnet to affect blood flow, that plays into the hands of, every... quack magnet device that anyone's ever tried to sell
for centuries.
Dubious, yeah, with dubious health claims. So let me tell you what the study actually is. It actually doesn't show anything that has any clinical applications. What the researchers did was look at the flow of blood through a tube that is specifically used to measure viscosity. So it's convenient. The tube is actually measuring the viscosity, and that's so they just applied an external magnetic field to that tube, with donated blood in it. And the power of the magnetic field that they were applying was 1.3 Tesla, which is extremely powerful. That's about how powerful an average MRI magnet is. So that's getting up there. And what they found was that after 1 minute of applying the magnetic field, the viscosity of the blood in the tube decreased by 20 to 30%. They ascribe this decrease in viscosity to the red blood cells in the blood clumping together like in a little chain, and therefore they have less surface area because, if you have two surfaces touching each other, that's less surface area exposed to the outside. And also they said that the blood cells tended to flow down the middle of the tube more and not rub up against the side of the tube, so that decreased the viscosity. The other bit is that they had to apply the magnetic field in the direction of the flow of the blood so that the tube was parallel to the lines of force of the magnet. So all that's fine and good. It was a proof of concept study, what would happen if you applied a magnetic field to blood cells. The problem was in the reporting. In addition from these researchers, the things the researchers themselves were saying, as well as the media reporting, and there's the range of the Daily Mail, which of course was the most sensationalistic, but even up to Science Magazine, which is a professional publication, is generally very good. They all sort of put the same spin on it, that this potentially could be an application that could reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes. But there's so many problems in trying to do that. There's actually two kinds of problems with this study. One is a theoretical one. The other is, even if it is true, applying it to a clinical claim. So I was really surprised that the Science Magazine report actually mentioned that the magnetic field may be having its effect due to the hemoglobin in the blood, which is almost certainly not the case. I mean, I think that that's the claim, right? If you ask like your average mall, refrigerator magnet salesman who's telling you that it's going to improve your wound healing and reduce your pain and arthritis, And you ask, well, how does it work? They'll give you some hand-waving explanation. You know, almost all the time it includes, well, it improves blood flow because the magnetic field attracts the hemoglobin in the blood.
Right, something about the iron in the blood.
Yeah, the hemoglobin has iron in it.
Yeah.
There you go, right?
Yeah, iron is always ferromagnetic, so therefore...
Right. Yeah. The Science Magazine article actually used the analogy of like iron filings lining up in a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
That's disappointing.
So, you know, as Rebecca and Evan are seeing, the iron in hemoglobin is non-ferromagnetic. I actually, you know, looked into that a little bit further. I wanted to find, well, what are the magnetic properties of hemoglobin? And I found a few studies. One was published 70 years ago by Linus Pauling.
Wow.
And we've learned a lot since then, but he basically got it right. I mean, he said that it depends on whether or not oxygen is bound to the hemoglobin or something else, like carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide or whatever. If nothing is bound to the hemoglobin, so you have deoxygenated hemoglobin, it's actually paramagnetic. A paramagnetic material will respond to an external magnetic field, but very weakly. You know, orders of magnitude less than a ferromagnetic material. And then as soon as the magnetic field is taken away, any effect goes away. So you could think, all right, well, maybe there's some paramagnetic effect, but the effect is so tiny it would be negligible.
Like the gravitational pull of Mars on my blood.
Yeah, right. Also, that's for deoxygenated blood, which doesn't really help you that much, right? If you're talking about improving arterial flow, where most of the blood is oxygenated. Now, oxyhemoglobin actually has a magnetic moment of zero because there are no free electrons, which apparently makes it very weakly diamagnetic, which is the opposite of paramagnetic in that it's it would cause an external magnetic field will repulse things that are diamagnetic, right? So you remember the levitating frog?
How could we forget?
Oh, yes. Right? Yeah,
because classic.
Living things tend to be diamagnetic, so a strong enough magnetic field, they'll be repulsed, you know, by the field. So oxygenated hemoglobin either won't have like any effect from an external magnetic field, or if it has, you know, if it's weakly diamagnetic, it would have a repulsive force, which would tend to have the opposite effect as to what was observed. So oxygenated blood would either not respond at all or would not, you know, chain up like was being described in this paper. So that's, you know, that's a big theoretical problem with this. Also, if you look at the image of the red cells sort of clumped together, they're not all nice and lined up. I mean, they are a little bit, but they're also, it's not perfectly lined up. They're clumpy in different directions as well. So that would be a significant problem in terms of flowing through capillaries, which is, you know, how the oxygen actually gets to the tissue is when it's flowing through the capillaries. Essentially, through a capillary, again, the smallest arteries, only one red blood cell can fit at a time. So any clumping like is being shown in this picture would actually impede flow through capillaries. But I suspect that this isn't happening at all, because if it were, then people would have problems in MRI scanners. And there's no ill effects. You know, your blood doesn't stop flowing through capillaries if you go through it in an MRI scan. It's possible this is all just an artifact, that the actual, even though, you know, the question of applicability aside, the effect may not even be real, given that there are theoretical problems with how they're saying the effect occurs, and we don't see this effect with MRI scans, at least what we would expect the clinical effects to be if it really were clumping like in the picture they're showing. So that's yet another problem. So if we think about applicability to people, you know, that which is of course where all the reporting went, preventing heart attacks, there, you know, there's lots of problems with this. You know, first, as I stated, this was done in a fairly large tube. We have no idea what the effects would be in smaller arteries, and I suspect if the claims are true, that would be a bad thing when you get down to the capillary level. But also, this effect was only observed when they had the tube lined up with, you know, a straight tube lined up with the magnetic field. How are you going to do that in a living organism where arteries are going every which way? Even the arteries in just the heart are going three-dimensionally. They're wrapping around the heart. You know what I mean? They're not just going in one direction. So I'm not sure how you would solve that problem. you know, maybe they found an interesting effect here. It's, you know, I wouldn't assume that based upon this one study. And I think that they didn't really deal very well with the discussion of possible mechanism. But even if you give them benefit of the doubt that this effect is genuine and it holds up to replication, the probability of this having the kind of application they're talking about is negligible to nothing. I guess it's possible that there may be some clever way to exploit this phenomenon to have a clinical activity, but just like applying a magnetic field to people in order to reduce their risk of events like heart attacks or strokes is not one of them. The other little wrinkle is that the effect lasts for 2 hours, and then the cells went back to their baseline. So again, even if it does work, it's not really a practical treatment for a prevention. Like, so you're going to subject yourself to a 1.3 Tesla magic for a magnet for 1 minute every 2 hours for the rest of your life. You know, I mean, what's the application? It's not like something you could wear or something you could have in your house, you know, at least not anytime soon. A 1.3 Tesla magnet is a massive piece of equipment. Terrible reporting on this one. It really was very disappointing.
And hemoglobin.
Hemoglobin.
Hemoglobin, hemoglobin. Is that Archie Bunker? Didn't you say that?
Women have hemoglobin.
Yeah. That's something you would say.
Sorry, I just assumed there was a missile out there. So.
All in the Family.
Dingbats.
Oh, thanks.
I've heard of it. It was written about the time Linus Pauling was going batshit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he was having his scientific meltdown around that time.
Exactly.
All right. Rebecca, give us a quick update about the guru who was responsible for people dying in the sweat lodge.
Yeah, I think we covered this back when the deaths were in the news.
We did.
Yeah. James A. Ray is the name of the so-called sweat lodge guru. And he became quite famous before this thanks to one Oprah Winfrey. He was on her show twice to discuss The Secret, which is the, you know, law of attraction, the idea that the universe will give you everything you want if only you believe hard enough that you already have it. This works very well for people like Oprah and James Ray, who make millions off of people purchasing their books and believing these philosophies. Unfortunately, the philosophies don't work for pretty much anyone else who's not already incredibly rich. So James A. Ray had a sweat lodge in Sedona, Arizona, or at least near Sedona, Arizona, which of course is like the hippie capital of the world, I think.
Of the multiverse.
Yeah, that too. And so he had the sweat lodge there, which is basically just a hut that's covered in blankets and things. And it gets very, very hot inside there, and people pay a tremendous amount of money to go and talk to Ray and then go into the sweat lodge and have this spiritual awakening. They paid nearly $10,000 each to go into this sweat lodge and
right to get delirious from dehydration.
Yeah,
right,
pretty much. Yeah. A little while ago, back in 2009, I believe it was, three people died in the sweat lodge. James Ray is on tape saying something along the lines of, you know, just feel free to give up and die. It's okay. Things like that. And so he was accused of being completely negligent. He was, prosecutors originally, were hoping to charge him with manslaughter, saying that he should have known that the sweat lodge ceremony would end in, would risk death and injury. But unfortunately, they didn't get that rather serious charge, but luckily they did convict Ray of a slightly less serious charge, but still quite serious charge of guilty by
double parking.
Guilty of negligent homicide. And that can it, a lot now depends on the sentencing. He could get anything from probation to more than 30 years in prison. So The prosecutors obviously are pushing for the stricter end of the spectrum, but who knows? What I find really interesting, though, is that the judge found that the prosecutors were not apparently able to prove that Ray knew the risks going in. However, Ray had these people sign waivers saying that they risked death. You know, I guess they weren't able to conclusively prove that he wasn't just being a total idiot when he let these people die in his sweat lodge. So I don't think we'll be hearing much about it on Oprah's network, but yeah, you can file this as yet another way that pseudoscience can kill.
Pseudoscience kills, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it is interesting. You know, how much due diligence do we hold people to? But and I think it's reasonable. I mean, if you're doing something, which I think your average person would realize that there's some risk here, right? You do the what's called, I guess, what's it called, the average guy or the common, you know, person rule.
Yeah, the man on the street sort of thing.
Yeah, like a reasonable person rule, I think is what it's called. So what would your average reasonable person think about this? You think it would be there's any health risk to staying in a sweat lodge so long that you begin to feel delirious? You know, I think most people realize that there's some medical risk there.
And yet people are willing to set aside that, you know, that feeling of risk because they trust someone, an authority, who's telling them that, you know, don't worry, I've done this before, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
You know, they've paid $10,000 to be there. Of course this guy's not going to kill them until he does.
Yeah, it's like when you get on a roller coaster, you're assuming
right.
that whatever infrastructure is in place, you know, it wouldn't let you get on the roller coaster if it were really dangerous. You're putting your trust in regulation and someone else's expertise, their assurances, whatever, their authority.
As you should.
Not always a good idea,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, for roller coasters, right. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. You have to do it sometimes.
But right? The fly-by-night carnival that's all rickety, maybe give it a pass.
Yeah, maybe not. You do a gestalt.
Personally, I like those more. You know, more fun when you think you actually might die.
But what if you had to sign a waiver before getting onto this?
Yeah, I think then I might back off. Yeah,
the possibility of decapitation.
That's because my fear of lawyers is greater than my fear of death.
I don't necessarily agree with your assessment, guys. I think a lot of people would be very trusting of something that they think is, you know, natural and earthy and that type of thing. I mean, it's, the sweat lodge thing has a huge, you know, it's very granola. So it makes people think, oh, this is like what the Indians, American Indians used to do. And, you know,
sweating out the toxins.
Yeah, I think that anything that doesn't require pills or medicine is going to be more likely to be trusted than something that does.
Yeah, I'm sure that contributed, but I don't think it takes away the notion that there a reasonable person would realize that there is some medical risk here. That, and if this guy is, he's the one who's in charge. He's the one who is, you know, setting up the whole thing and telling people to trust him and do it, that he has a certain responsibility to make sure he knows what he's doing, that he's not going to push it beyond safe limits. And he clearly didn't do that. Yeah, but it's good to see, you know, people appropriately being held responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
It happens sometimes.
Yeah, and it unfortunately won't stop the practice. Others are going to come along and do the exact same stuff, and there'll be plenty of people willing to do it.
It's interesting that a lot of societies developed mechanisms of generating encephalopathy, right? Basically of putting the brain in a situation where it's not functioning well as part of a spiritualist, of a spiritual ritual. Right, we're going to get you to go on your spiritual journey by giving you, a drug that's a hallucinogen, you know, or by, you know, depriving you of nutrition for a couple of days, or of putting you in a hot house until you get dehydrated.
How else are you going to see God?
Right. Well, it's funny, you know, that's the reliable way to generate a bizarre experience is to make sure your brain not function properly.
That's an awesome statement, Steve. That's awesome. That could mean so many different things.
Human beings have been very ingenious in discovering all kinds of ways to get high. Is the other thing.
That's true.
Every culture, pretty much every culture found something in their environment that would get them high.
Don't snort bath salts, kids.
I just suddenly
suddenly had a vision of somebody hearing me say that, going out and snorting them, and then I'm on trial.
You're on the hook.
Right.
Disclaimer. Don't do anything Rebecca tells you to do.
Whatever you do, don't eat so much nutmeg that you trip. Okay.
What about toad licking? Toad licking.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, you imagine no TV, no internet, no smartphone. I mean, you do a lot of experimenting. Like, hey, let's try this. Let's snort this. Mm-hmm. Let's try smoking that.
And then have sex.
Well, it all started with the trial and error of eating plants and different animals and all that stuff.
That's funny. You give it to the weakest person in the tribe. Here, try this. Try it. Come on. Do it. Like, oh boy. See what the reaction is.
Exactly.
Well, I think we all had that friend in third grade who would eat anything. I think that sort of person has gone back until the beginning of humankind, you know, and has made us all a better race.
God bless him. God bless him.
There was some kid in high school that ate a fly, and I remember thinking, I'm never talking to him again.
And now, you know, you should really be thanking him for, you know, helping the species survive.
What was his name? Spider-Man?
Oh, my God. Really, Evan?
That's the best you could do.
What was his name? Bug eater guy?
Aren't roasted flies like a delicacy in Mexico?
New Mexico.
What's that show where the guy eats the most disgusting things in the world?
Fear Factor.
Oh, Anthony Bourdain? No.
Not Fear Factor.
On the Travel Network.
Yeah. Well, so there's a show where a guy eats the most disgusting things around the world. You can imagine.
Yeah.
We do watch it, and oh my gosh, what the hell did he eat? He ate a sea cucumber the other night.
Oh my goodness! But he did. He did.
Thing was vile.
I've had
fried flies. Yeah.
Fried flies. Try saying that three times.
Fried flies.
Fried fries.
That is. Why?
Don't even say it, Jay. Don't even go there.
Hey, insects are a staple food in much of the world. They're very
good protein.
They have a lot of protein.
They're very nutritious.
Yeah,
lots of protein. Yeah. You know.
I know I'm programmed by my culture. You know, like I know there's cultures out there. They're like, sure, I'll eat that gigantic slug that's living in a log. But even though intellectually I get it, I cannot make the emotional connection in any way. It's disgusting to me.
Well, goat head soup. Come on, delicious.
My standing favorite is maggot cheese.
Yeah.
You know, cheese with maggots running through it. I mean, you know, what gets better than that?
In Peru, they have, I think it's actually happening right now. I could be wrong on that. But they have a guinea pig festival in which they dress up guinea pigs in funny little outfits and sort of parade them around, and then they eat them. And, you know, I'm a vegetarian, but I'm generally okay with eat meeting if done in, you know, a sustainable manner. But I am very much against that sort of animal cruelty before killing an animal. You should see them.
I know.
They're wearing
put them in a suit before you kill them.
That's they're wearing little hats and dresses, and they look miserable.
MG.
Oh, that's awful.
It's the most adorable, horrible thing ever.
Yeah, how do you do that? Oh, isn't he cute? And then, you know, 2 hours later, bacon.
Here comes the axe.
And tender.
Those are the last moments of that guinea pig's life, is wearing your tiny little dress and heels. And then getting eaten.
Now, Rebecca, do not criticize another culture.
Why not? That's funny.
They're just as valid as any other culture.
What if it's funny to criticize?
Yeah. What would Perry say about
that? Hey, I criticize American cruelty to animals as well. It's
true.
You know.
That's true. Yeah, that's always our out. It's like, well, we criticize everything that way. We can criticize whatever we want. We don't have to
It's just funnier when cruelty to animals doesn't involve horrific factory farms, but in fact involves dressing them up
outfits.
In tiny little outfits. Yeah.
Jay.
Yeah.
How's the space station doing?
The space station is fine, but there's some really horrific stats that I just read a lot about that were in the wake of the space station almost getting creamed by some space junk.
Space junk.
So, yeah, pretty darn close.
Some space debris that's obviously orbiting the Earth. It, I don't know, cruised, it flipped. Like, what do you call when something passes you at 29,000 miles an hour? What is that? Like, it
buzzed?
It buzzed.
Mm-hmm.
We got to come up with a cooler word for, like, when like, zips past you that fast. But on Tuesday, the 28th of June, the International Space Station had a pretty close call with a piece of space debris. I couldn't find anything on how big it was. I don't think we actually know how big the piece was. So it came within. Now, what do you think they consider close? How far away was it?
Oh,
1,100
kilometer.
Feet.
Kilometer.
Three.
I did the nice thing and excused myself.
Three angstroms.
Yeah, it came pretty close. This was an exceptionally close call in Earth
space
orbit
terms.
Yeah. So right now we have six people on board the space station, and they all had a run to the Soyuz spacecrafts that are there in case the space station has any significant problems. They're there to ferry the people back to Earth if anything happens. So Lark Holworth, who leads the team at NASA that tracks the station's trajectory, said, "We believe the probability that it would hit the station was about 1 in 360.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, pretty significant number there. The impact was so likely that the astronauts unclamped the freaking Soyuz capsule from the space station. So if something did happen, if that piece of debris happened to hit the space station, they could have had a depressurization, you know, explosion or implosion. Some really nasty things can happen if the space station gets breached. So they were literally one move away from undocking the capsule. They unclamped it from the space station, and all they had to do was press a button to get ejected from the space station, and that would have been it. So they weren't sure. They really didn't know during those 4 minutes that it was within range. They were there ready to get out, so it's pretty damn serious. NASA said that the chance of a space collision is 1 in 5 over a 10-year lifespan of the space station.
Yeah, that's not something you want to hear right before you go on board.
Yeah, they knew 15 hours ahead of time, but they didn't have time to move the station safely. You know, the space station, it's a pretty big deal to change the orbit or the trajectory of the space station. And they have rockets on the space station. They also have had the space shuttle nudge the space station. And they've had to do this 12 times and move away from debris that they predicted would cross paths. But, you know, in 15 hours, it wasn't enough time for them to figure out where to move it to and everything. You know, there's consequences every time they change its path.
Well, wait, why didn't they just put the shields up?
Yeah, right? I've thought about that, Bob. It's too bad. Wait. You know, eventually I'm sure we'll have some type of, you know, thing that does something to debris coming near or whatever, but
laser.
They'll put a repulsive ray inside an obelisk. You go inside the obelisk and then it shoots the ray out.
Yeah.
And pushes it away.
It is dangerous. They consider, you know, being in orbit very dangerous now, you know, and that's, you know, not just from getting on a rocket ship and you know, shooting your ass all the way off the surface of the planet up into orbit, but it's from being up there. There's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of unpredictable things going on. So the only other time this happened was in March of 2009 when they had another close call. They called a flyby. So NASA estimated that for each six-month period, there's a 1 in 100 chance that some or all of the space station crew might need to evacuate.
Wow.
But you wonder, I mean, should they, if they're going to build stations like that for long-term occupation, should they put some physical shields in place? I mean, you could imagine putting, you know, a couple inches of steel outside of the station to act
yeah,
as
I wonder
a literal
if that's a,
shield.
If that's a financial
as a
issue
shield,
or if it's a physics problem.
Yeah, is there some practical reason not to do that?
Yeah, I'm sure all of those things come into play. I mean, you know, the cost per pound to get things into outer space,
that's,
you know.
That's key. I mean, that's the big problem.
And that cost for the United States has significantly gone up since, you know, we have one more space shuttle going off. And then we're going to be renting space.
Yeah, I'd still go up there, though, in a heartbeat.
I wouldn't.
Because of,
No, I'm just so claustrophobic with stuff like that. I know I wouldn't be able to deal with it.
Yeah, you wouldn't get past the psych profile where they put you in a little room for 3 days.
Yeah, I'll be in there for like 15 minutes and I'll be crying. I'm just, oh, please, I don't want to go. Let me out.
Is that a Skinner box? They throw you in.
Rebecca, would you go?
Yeah, I would go. Because
you'd be scared
often,
though.
Yeah, I'd be scared shitless. but you know what? You know what it is, Jay? It's free drinks for the rest of your life. If you make it home, you never buy a drink again.
I mean, you are pretty damn cool, but Rebecca,
that would
if you
be
were
your
like
ultimate
Rebecca,
motivation.
Rebecca Watson,
right.
You know,
space
astronaut.
Explorer. Yeah.
Yeah, space explorer.
Yeah, that's what would be on my business cards. Not astronaut, space explorer, space conqueror.
Imagine, you know, you're in that and you're flying it and you're calm as a cucumber. That's cool as a cucumber. That's pretty awesome.
Well, at least on the outside.
I don't think anyone's calm as a cucumber, Jay, but I think they're all
exhilarated as all hell. Well, first of all, it's
cool
as
hell.
A cucumber. But
what did I say?
Calm. Which is what Jay said,
calm.
Which I find actually quite enjoyable, the picture
of a
cucumber.
What are you calm as? Calm as a what?
Calm as a calm person?
Calm as a...
koala? Yeah, koalas are pretty
calm
damn calm.
Calm as a koala.
Calm as a koala.
Yeah,
calm as a cadaver.
As a tree sloth.
Comma, chameleon.
Yes.
lower than a snake belly.
Comma, chameleon.
The comet chameleon.
Evan.
Steve.
How you doing?
I'm fine tonight. How are you, sir?
Good. Are you ready for Who's That Noisy?
I am. Is everybody else ready?
Yes, let's hear it.
All right.
I did a physics degree at Imperial College, and then I did 4 years postgraduate in the motions of zodiacal dust in the solar system. And then something called me, and I had to go.
One of the greatest rock and roll legends in the history of that fine art.
Boy George?
Close, yeah. A little less colorful. Our friend Brian Harold May.
Brian May. Yep, nice guy.
From the rock band Queen. And Planet Rock's draw poll in May of 2005 voted him the 7th greatest guitarist of all time. He is also an astrophysicist.
Which is why he's cool.
Really?
He is an astrophysicist. Yes. Quite a famous one. arguably one of the most famous ones. Not because of the work he's doing, but, you know, because of his past associations.
And who got that correct, Evan?
Ashley Zinnick, who answered both via email and on the message board. He was the first one to correct.
That's a good way to hedge your bets.
Good job, Ashley.
Okay, folks.
Yeah, you know where this is going.
Got your ears on? Because here comes this week's Who's That Noisy?
It does sound like a kid's xylophone.
It does. It's not. I assure you. It's something much cooler.
Okay.
So, take your best guess. Post your message on our forum or send us an email, info@theskepticsguide.org. And, of course, good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Well, let's go on with our interview. We're here at Nexus 2011, and we are joined now by Eugenie Scott from the NCSE, the National Center for Science Education. Eugenie, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Nice to be back.
Eugenie, you were talking about the fact that we need to continue to be vigilant about creationism. This isn't a battle that we have won, not in the scientific arena, but in the public arena.
No. Nobody enjoys my talk.
Bearer of bad news, I guess.
That's right. No, what I was talking about in yesterday's presentation was more about the way that the creationist movement has evolved to the legal constraints that the Establishment Clause of our Constitution has put on them. And so when creation science came along, the constitutional provisions against advocating religion in the public schools came down on them hard. And the court said, you can't do it. And then when intelligent design came along, the same thing happened. So what they've done is moved to what actually is a very old strategy of theirs of just straight-up denigrating evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And
they went back to their roots.
They went back. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've always had this sort of parallel push for, you know, simultaneously trying to get some form of creationism into the classroom. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, they've only recently given up on that as a legal strategy. I mean, trust me, there's plenty of it going on, and you know, you just don't hear about it. Lots of teachers are bringing creationism into
just
the classroom.
Just quietly doing it,
freelancing, so to speak. But at least you don't have any policies that school boards or states are passing that, you know, for straight up teaching of creation science or intelligent design. You were saying they went back to their roots, and that's a good way to put it, because consistent from the beginning of the creation science movement back in the 1960s, they have always argued for what they call the two-model approach, mm-hmm. where you have either special creation or you have evolution. Those are the only two possibilities. So logically, if not A, then B, right?
And they're false models, not theories.
False dichotomy.
Oh, no. Well, they call them theories, but obviously as scientific
remember,
theories.
At the time, they were using the term models. My impression was that they wanted to avoid the word theory.
Possibly.
Because they wanted to say, well, evolution is not a theory. It's just a model.
And no.
Creation's a model, so they're equal.
Or they're, but whatever they are, they're equal.
They're equal. I mean, that was sort of a way whatever to achieve they call it. The perception of equality. Between
them. Whether they call it a model or a theory, they're equal. Yeah. So you know, special creation or evolution. So the argument was, well, if we can just disprove evolution, then creation wins by default.
Yeah.
I mean, that you know, if not A, then B. Logically, there's actually nothing wrong with that. It's the premises that are the problem.
Right.
So they've always had this this current running along with trying to get creationism into the schools, trying to convince the public and particularly convince students that evolution really is weak theory. There's nothing to it. Scientists are giving up on it and all that. And so now that the strategy of trying to get creationism into the schools has just run into it just a complete brick wall of mm-hmm. the establishment clause, they are really focusing on this denigration strategy. And the way we're seeing this working out these days and for the last several years is through the establishment of what they call or what has been called academic freedom acts. And it's a very clever packaging because they're drawing on American cultural values of fairness, of an enthusiasm that we all have. You know, we want our kids to be critical thinkers,
right.
So critical thinking is worked into this. And the idea of academic freedom for teachers, you know, free teachers to teach what they consider good science.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all ideas that resonate very strongly with the American
right.
public. And it on the surface, it does not look like an Establishment Clause problem because there's never any mention of evolution. There's never any mention of religion, never any mention of creationism. It just sounds like, oh, we're just trying to improve the education of our kids.
Right, but they're singling out evolution and sometimes the Big Bang.
Yeah. And the fact that, and they've even gotten cleverer about that too, because there was a Supreme Court decision back in the 60s, the Epperson versus Arkansas case, where the Supreme Court called into question the Arkansas law because it singled out evolution from everything else in the
mm-hmm.
curriculum. So we think that maybe the bundling of evolution with things like global warming or cloning and other, you know, conservative
gravity.
Christian enthusiasms. No, gravity's fine.
Earth's not around the sun.
That's not a problem. But bundling of evolution with these other causes.
Yeah.
Could be a way of trying to avoid the Epperson constraint of singling out evolution.
Right.
But still, this is about evolution.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's not about critical thinking. Trust me on this, guys.
And whenever I see the work you guys are doing, particularly with the textbooks in Texas, I'm always shocked when I'm reading over it. If I didn't have you guys there to point out like where the creationists are trying to insert in the language, I probably would have missed it. I would just skim right over it and be like,
subtle.
Yeah, that sounds fine. You know? And then, but then you guys are there to say, well, no, because they're going to take this and this is what they're going to do with
There's
that.
A purpose
this
to
is
it.
Why
yeah,
they
that's
can't
right.
do that.
That's right.
You know? So I really appreciate the work you guys are doing in that respect because they really are insidious and it seems like it's taking a lot more detective work to sniff out exactly what they're doing and how they're doing and how to stop it.
Well, you know, like everything else, this movement has a history. And if you understand the history, then you're more, and, you know, God knows we're up to our nostrils in this. This is what we do. Then it's easier to recognize these kinds of buzzwords and you know, like I was joking yesterday, not really joking in my talk, that if you ever see the word balanced in the same paragraph as the word evolution, you're about 95% sure that paragraph was written by a creationist there are just certain words that come up.
Yeah.
Another clue is evidences. Mm-hmm. You know, scientists don't talk about the evidences for gravitation. I mean, we don't talk about the evidences for cell division or the evidences for enzyme function. We talk about evidence in the singular. But evidences in the plural is commonly found in the creationist literature, and it comes from Christian apologetics. Mm-hmm. Because evidences in the plural is a term of art within that particular area of theology. Evidences are what you present to somebody to try to, you know, bring them to Jesus and help them understand the importance of this point, you know, conversion and like that. So evidences is another one of the, but I think what you're talking about, Becky, is Rebecca, is the,
Rachel, sorry, we're Rachel, familiar enough. Yeah,
that's
right.
Stacey, that's right. Whatever.
Is Ms. Watson, is the much more subtle kinds of things, like with the Texas standards. There was a line in there talking about, you know, the importance of, a line that was added, a standard that was added by the creationist Board of Education down there, a line about the students should learn about cell function. Well, that's not quite the phrase, but as soon as we saw that, we thought, uh-huh, this is the intelligent design guys at work.
Yeah.
Because cell function and the bacteria flagellum and all this other kind of stuff is really key to their design.
Irreducible complexity.
In England, there's a real problem with American creationist groups sneaking in and getting into private religious schools and setting up shop there and kind of getting their little tendrils into the government. And so right now, it's not a big problem in England, at least. And I think Ireland, it's the same thing is happening. But I'm really worried that they don't have the tools.
Yeah,
there's no one there like Jeannie who can read through that.
Oh, yes. The good news is there's a British Center for Science Education modeled after NCSE, the American. And I met a number of these people when I was there a month or so ago. And, you know, really, really a great group. And they do a lot of the same sort of thing that we do in terms of if a teacher has a problem, they can give that teacher advice and what to do. And you know, but it's a much smaller problem. But the big problem in England that I see, or Great Britain that I see, is that, as you said, the creationists are bringing their literature in, and most of it, of course, is anti-evolution. You know, most of it is the gaps in the fossil record. Now, the second law of thermodynamics proves evolution can't take place, and all these other moldy old arguments that we've refuted so many times, we're sick of them. But the teachers in Great Britain, although they're not, you know, they're not in favor of teaching creationism, they actually don't know much about evolution.
Yeah. Right.
And the, you know, much like our North American teachers. And the problem is that when a kid comes up with this literature, says, gee, teacher, you know, look here, you know, Tiktaalik is nothing but a fish or what. A lot of these teachers are going to say, well, you know, geez, I didn't know that evolution was in so much trouble.
Right.
I mean, what I'd like to see. And actually, this was a little bit embarrassing when it was revealed by some surveys that British teachers really didn't know much about evolution. I would like to see the British professors in their post-secondary education doing a lot better job with science education.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this may be the wake-up call.
Yeah, right. There's always that upside to pseudoscience. We were chatting about this yesterday, actually, with Phil Plait and Brian
ironically.
Dunning. The denialists and pseudoscientists and anti-scientists actually force the scientists to actually be much better at their job.
And to think more about the nature of science.
Yeah.
I know that happened to me. You know, when I first, my gateway pseudoscience, if you will, was creationism back in 1971, but who's counting? and, you know, it really did make me think more about philosophy of science, about, well, now, okay, so they say they're doing science, but I'm doing science, and so how are we coming up with such different conclusions? So, you know, let's look at what we're doing here. Oh, yes, look where they've gone astray.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I absolutely, for myself personally, think I understand evolution much better than I ever would have if I didn't spend as much time as I have dissecting creationist arguments to find out exactly what was wrong with them, because they're subtle in many cases.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I've had this sort of a similar conversation with a lot of our audience. it's this idea that none of us would really be interested in skepticism or science at this stage in our lives if in the past we hadn't had an interest in some kind of paranormal or pseudoscience. You know, like when I was a kid, I loved cryptozoological creatures and you know, ESP.
Don't you want there to be a Bigfoot?
Yes.
I would love for there to be a Bigfoot.
Yes. I've got
wait, there's no Bigfoot?
Well, there is down at my at my table, at the skeptic table downstairs. I've got Squatchy, the Bigfoot. but yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of us share this real love of the goofy sort of out there ESP, that whole world.
We're not that different from the people we're trying to persuade.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful because, you know, for me, it was first my love of figuring out a con that led me to realize, like, oh, okay, so some cons are bad science. And the flip side of the bad science is this good science. And as I'm, like, debunking this, I'm also getting a real appreciation of how life really is. And that's what got me interested in science in my 20s.
Yeah. Jeannie, thanks for joining us as well. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Everyone ready for this week?
Yes.
Carpe diem.
Well, let's get going. Ready? Item number one. A recent extensive DNA analysis of coconuts indicates that all modern cultivated coconuts derive from a single ancestral variety located in Indonesia. Item number two. Paleontologists have discovered fossilized eyes 515 million years old. They are surprisingly complex compound eyes with about 3,000 lenses. And item number three, a new study finds that wars have been increasing steadily over the last century by 2% per year on average. Rebecca, since you're doing so well,
oh man,
and since I am a strong believer in regression to the mean, I want you to go first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So, coconut come from a single ancestral variety in Indonesia. Sure. Why not? Sure. I don't know anything about coconuts. I don't even...
You've got to love a
bunch
of them.
I don't know how to know where coconuts are found. So I don't know. That sounds believable to me, though. Fossilized eyes, 515 million years old. Now, that sounds slightly less believable, if only because eyes are squishy things that I expect to disintegrate pretty quickly after death. But to have 3,000 lenses, it seems that calling them surprisingly complex is the understatement of the year. Who needs 3,000 lenses? No one. No one needs to. Maybe that's why they died. Too many lenses. And then the idea that war has increased steadily over the last century by 2% per year on average, that doesn't seem right. So I'm going to go ahead and say that that one is, in fact, the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
See here, something about the DNA analysis of the coconut, something about Indonesia strikes me as making sense. Other than that, I don't know a hell of a lot of where coconuts could have possibly originally come from. So based on that vague feeling, I will go with that one as probably true. The second one, complex eyes 500 million years ago, that is interesting. I don't share Rebecca's skepticism on preservation of that, but it does seem somewhat remarkable and pretty cool. But I also have to agree with Rebecca on three, though, that, yeah, the war thing, yeah, too many unknowns, lots of questions, and 2% per year on average for the past century. I have another vague memory of the opposite kind of being true. So based on my vague feelings, I will agree with Rebecca and say that the war thing is baloney.
Okay, Evan?
The coconuts. The about the coconuts is... I don't see why there couldn't be derived from a single ancestral variety in Indonesia. I can't see any problem with that. Definitely the fossilized eyes from 515 million years ago is interesting. Not that there were eyes on creatures back then, but how complex they were. This one about the wars, the last one, is really tough. Until I remember, strange thing, a couple years ago, I remember someone telling me that this was like in 2009, and they said there were like 25 or 30 active wars going on in the world at the time. And I'm like, no way, it can't be that many. It's gonna be, you know, maybe 6, 8, 10, but like 25 or so. And sure enough, he directed me to the website, and there were lots of little conflicts that we don't know about. It's not part of our daily news intake. Well, I'm not going to bet against Bob and Rebecca, so that's going to, their gravity is going to pull me into that one. So I'll say the wars.
Always safe.
Not always, but this time it is. Wars is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the one about the coconuts. So all coconuts are coming from one type of coconut in Indonesia. And like all the coconuts that we eat today, I don't know. Isn't there different kinds of coconuts that we eat today? Like, there's not just one type of coconut.
Evolution,
out there.
Hello.
Speciation.
I'm saying that we don't eat just one type of coconut today. You know, it makes me think when Steve first read this, I'm like, well, did every fruit and vegetable and all that start from basically one place? Like, I don't know. I don't know. Something about this seems a little weird to me. The one about the discovering eyes, 515 million years old. You know, and the first thing I thought of again when Steve said this was like, what? You know, I'm thinking like mammalian eyes, and I realized, well, these have to be something else. You know, yeah, that is really cool. Yeah, sure. I mean, like, where do you find something like that that's that old?
Do you know, I have an allergy. I developed a food allergy to coconuts in the recent years. I ate it all my life. It was fine just a couple years ago. And guess what happens when I eat coconuts? My eyes start to itch and water.
Mm.
There is a total... Wait, maybe all three of these have to do with Evan. But I don't see why they wouldn't find some type of fossilized eye or whatever from some dig somewhere. Sure, that's not crazy. New study finds that the wars have been increasing 2% a year on average. I mean, if you just think about the wars that we've had in the past 100 years, we've had a ton of war. I mean, there's always a war going on somewhere. So the only one here that I feel like I had a weird feeling about was the coconut. I don't think that is real. I think that's the
join
fake.
Us.
Make your eyes itch.
I'll never join you and Rebecca, Bob. You have, it's my pattern.
Jay's going out on a limb by himself this time. All right. Well, you all agree, for some strange reason, that paleontologists have discovered fossilized eyes 550 million years old.
We completely agree.
They are surprisingly complex compound eyes with about 3,000 lenses. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh, that's right. 3,000 lenses. It has to be like a freaking fly eye or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. It's a compound eye, as it says in the description.
Well, excuse me for being overly exhausted.
Seems like a lot. I don't know.
It is a lot. That's what was surprising about it. Now, the interesting thing is that there's no creature to go with the eyes.
What?
So
they just found a pair of eyes?
Yeah, they don't know what creature they belong to. They think it's probably some kind of a giant
that
shrimp.
Awesome.
Or time travel and someone jumped back, whoops, too far, and left their eyes.
Now, which is really interesting that it might be a giant shrimp because the only kind of shrimp I will eat is coconut shrimp.
Oh, boy.
There you go. All right. These are found.
That's some good shrimp with the dipping sauce, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, with the margarita dipping sauce.
I love that.
This is an international team led by scientists from the South Australian Museum and the University of Adelaide found these fossils. I believe they were found in Australia. So one of the surprising things is that this is, you know, 515 million years ago. This is not too long after the development of multicellular life, like, what, 560 million years ago. So they were saying that, which I agree, that there must have been massive selective pressure to develop eyes.
Well, yeah, kind of nice, handy to have, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the pressures are so strong because seeing a little bit better is a huge advantage. Once you're on that path, you're going to develop eyes fairly quickly. And so, you know, this is more developed than they thought they would have gotten to by this point, but again, it's not surprising. Now, I also learned something new about compound eyes. You know how, like, in the movies when they show you, like, the fly's eye view of things? And they
look through a kaleidoscope or something.
Yeah, it's like the movie The Fly, where there's a lot of images reproduced in each facet, in each lens of the compound eye. That's not how they work. Each lens is a pixel. It's not a reproduction
whole
of
image,
the whole image.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
so those museum gift shop kaleidoscope things have been lying to me all this time?
Yes, absolutely.
Get your money back now.
See how a fly sees? No, it's not how it works at all. So this thing had 3,000 lenses that had 3,000 pixel vision.
That's not
high res.
That's that's low res.
It's pretty good, though. 3,000, that's a lot. You know, even there are things alive today with compound eyes, like the horseshoe crab has only 1,000 pixels. The best, you know, what compound eye, name the creature and the number of pixels. What do you think is the best?
28,000.
Oh, you read it?
Yeah, I must
have. Well, what is it?
It's the dragonfly, 28,000 pixels, which is pretty good. You know, you think, you know, 28,000 pixels is...
Yeah, that's high res, dude.
It's not too bad. It's not high res. I mean, you think about a 1-megapixel camera, you know, is...
Well, high res for a fly.
Yeah, for a fly. It's pretty good.
It's pretty fly for a fly.
You're pretty fly for a white guy.
But it's good. That's
HD for a fly.
That's science. So let's go to number
three, two,
one.
Yes.
A recent extensive DNA analysis of coconuts indicates that all modern cultivated coconuts derived from a single ancestral variety located in Indonesia.
I'm totaled.
Jay, you're by yourself and thinking that this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks that this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Whoa!
Jay!
Awesome.
Good job, well Jay.
Done. Way to smell it.
It paid off!
Of course
it's right.
There was an extensive DNA analysis of coconuts. And the researchers who set out to do this thought that, with all of the shipping of coconuts around the world, that they were expecting to find that it was just what they called a mishmash, right? That the genes were so mixed up among all the coconuts from around the world that you weren't going to be able to tell much. But actually, they were able to discover a few very interesting things. The pattern in the history of the movement of coconuts around the world was much more preserved than they had thought. One of the surprising things was that coconuts, even though they were thought of as the cultivated form of coconuts, was thought of as a single cultivar, that in fact there are two distinct types of coconuts in the world, you know, in terms of the cultivated kind, not wild coconuts. And there's a Pacific variety and there is a Indian Ocean derived variety, and that they think that they're distinct enough that they probably were actually cultivated completely separately, not that they share a common cultivated ancestor. So they're very distinct. There's one type of coconut is more triangular and long. The other one is more rounded and has more of the sweet water in it. And the names are Niu Kafa and Niu Vai, are the Samoan names for the two varieties of coconut.
Cool. Coconuts.
Surprising.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
who knew?
Yeah.
Not me.
No, I'm allergic to
Which means that a new study finds that wars have been increasing steadily over the last century by 2% per year on average is very depressing science.
I knew it.
not enough to guess it, though.
No, I didn't.
This was research done by the University of Warwick and Humboldt University, and they looked at, I mean, of course you come up with some criteria for what counts as a war. As long as you apply those criteria consistently, you know, over the time period, then you can compare apples to apples, right? And they found, you know, the graph goes up and down, of course, but there is a fairly steady increase over time, and it averages out to 2% per year. Now, they say that the two main reasons for this increase...
Population growth.
And Jay, actually, your entire science or fiction analysis this week was uncharacteristically cogent for you.
Ha!
You did a good job.
That's called a backhanded elbow.
How is that? I don't know how to take that.
Really.
By the back of his hand. That's how you take that.
That was a
compliment. Wait, remind me of what did I say that was correct? Just so I could.
Well, I mean, you said there's something definitely fishy about the whole coconut thing going back to just one variety. That was correct. And with the wars, your analysis of the wars matched pretty much what these guys said. Yeah. That humans are tribal and warlike, but the two factors, and you actually did hit upon one of the factors, you know, that we're getting better at making war, and they said that the cost of waging war has come down. You know, it's just economics. It's, you can get weapons cheaper, you can wage war more cheaply than it used to cost, and that therefore lowered the threshold, the economic threshold for waging war. But also, interestingly, they said there's a lot more borders among countries.
That's true.
So I guess there's just more political borders. There's more borders to fight over, I guess. So that also is contributing to the steady increase in the number of wars.
You know, my vague feelings suck.
Yep.
Yeah, except when they don't, yep. Right? It's like when they're right, like, I knew it. And when they're wrong, you have some excuse. But
you're right.
It is. It's true. But it doesn't stop you from thinking that there was something to your vague feeling when it just happened by chance to be correct.
And it's not going to stop you in the future. You won't calculate. Right. You won't figure that in your calculations.
Right.
So you've got to go by something sometimes.
Yeah. If you don't know, you don't know. You just got to go by what feels right, what makes sense. So Jay, the sole victor this week. Good job.
Well done, Jay.
Thank you all.
Brava.
Thank you.
3 weeks in a row. Is that supposed to be some kind of an insult, Bob?
Yeah, what was that? Are you insulting him because it's an insult to be a woman?
You insulted both Jay and all women at the same time.
Yeah, well done.
You know, I was hoping nobody would notice, but hey,
good
whatever.
Way to be a sore loser.
I thought it was a nice subtle dig.
That reminds me of a SpongeBob episode where SpongeBob is training his snail for a race, and he calls him, he refers to the snail, it was more than one snail he was training, he calls them ladies, and he says, I call you ladies because it's demeaning, right? And then Sandy, the female and token mammal character on the show.
Token mammal.
She's a squirrel.
But she lives in the ocean?
She lives in the ocean. She always has an air squirrel helmet on.
In an air dome.
Yeah, she's in an air dome.
Come on, they don't totally break all the laws of physics.
Suddenly realizes that for some reason she needs to kick SpongeBob's ass the next time she sees him.
Steve, I have a quote for this week.
Do you? I'm shocked.
This quote was sent in by a listener and then came recommended by Evan.
That's true. It came with my recommendation.
Your endorsement?
And blessing.
So this quote was sent in by Peter McCulley. And Peter is from Auckland, New Zealand.
What is that?
What, Rebecca?
Nothing. Go on.
What? You don't like Irish accents?
Is that what that was?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And you said he's from Auckland.
His name is Peter McCulley, and he's from Auckland, New Zealand.
Auckland, New Zealand.
This is a quote from one of my absolute favorite people of the past, Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
If the human race wishes to have a prolonged and indefinite period of material prosperity, they have only got to behave in a peaceful and helpful way toward one another, and science will do for them all they wish and more than they can dream. Winston Churchill!
Now, you know what the contemporary version of that quote is. No, apparently not.
No.
It is. Science works, bitches.
Jay?
I believe you mean science, it works, bitches.
Yeah, that's that. If Winston Churchill were alive today, that's what he would say. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Sure.
Bye.
Hey, good night.
Good night.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or your portal of choice.